Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety Inc. podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to both the food safety industry as well as cannabis and hemp. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjrfsi.com/webinars or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Or good morning, depending on wherever you're joining us from, and welcome to today's webinar, 2022, an in-depth look at emerging challenges and risk factors in the food industry. My name's Amy. I'm a member of the marketing team at Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety, Inc. I'll be here facilitating today's webinar and offering technical support to our speakers should the need arise. Today, we're very excited to be welcoming a group of industry professionals for the discussion, and we'll be introducing them to you all a little bit later on in the broadcast, but I'm going to go right ahead and introduce Paul DeMarin now. Paul is our Senior Vice President of Food Safety and Supply Chain here at PJRFSI. Paul joined us in January of 2020 and has over 35 years of experience in the hospitality, service, and retail agri-food sectors. Paul's a board member of the OFPA, that's the Ontario Food Protection Association. He's also an advisory council member with the George Washington University School of Business for their digital marketing certificate program. And before he came to PJRFSI, Paul worked for 17 years in the certification industry and had clients in sectors from food safety and supply chain to brand protection and quality. He also worked for many years in management system certification. And prior to that, he was a professional chef and a consultant for over 20 years. So Paul, I'll be happy to hand things over to you and you can get us started and introduce our speakers.
Thank you very much, Amy. I appreciate that introduction. I think it's time that I shorten that up pretty drastically so that you don't have to talk so much about myself. So I appreciate that. It's time for our panel discussion. I'm really looking forward to this, and we're going to get this kicked off here today by introducing our speakers. So let me first start with Jill Stuber. Jill's a true professional, having served in quality and the food safety teams for several multi-million dollar food companies and food industry support companies, and at both corporate levels and frontline facility levels as well. She's had an amazing journey over 25 years in the food world, and she holds degrees in food science and quality management. And she's a professional certified coach through Learning Journeys, which is an accredited program through the International Coaching Federation. Jill's desire to make our lives better for her FSQ teams led her to find coaching. And it was in that coaching journey, along with her food safety technical training experiences, that inspired Jill to create a safe place of support, understanding, and growth for other food safety and quality professionals. And it was in that moment that Food Safety Coach was born. So welcome, Jill. Thank you very much. Next, I would like to introduce you to Jennifer Crandall. Jennifer is an old friend of ours, and she is the CEO and founder of Safe Food En Route. Jen has a food science degree from Purdue University with 8 years of manufacturing experience and 12 years at the Kroger corporate offices. In 2018, she founded Safe Food En Route. And Jen and her team, I know them all very well, and they're in the food safety consulting space with a focus on the FSMA rules or Food Safety Modernization Act, FSVP, and supplier compliance management. And the mission over at SFER is to make corporate food safety programs accessible to small and mid-sized companies using systems that are intentionally designed with love for people and food. Welcome, Jen, and thank you again for joining us. Now we have another new panelist here today, and I know Evan very well as well. We worked together in the past many years ago. And let me introduce you to Evan Rosen. Evan is the president of Excelsior Food Safety Solutions. He's also the recipient of the 2019 BRCGS approved training partner and consultant of the year. He is a BRCGS principal trainer, which is the trainer of the trainers and auditors in food packaging and storage and distribution standards. He's registered SQF trainer and auditor, as well as an FSSC 22,000 instructor. And he's also an FSPCA lead instructor for PCQI human food and animal food and the foreign supplier verification program. He has over 20 years of experience in the food and packaging manufacturing industries, and that includes various certification bodies like AIB and SAI Global, which is where we met. And he's been in manufacturing as well for companies like Carry Out Perk Up as the quality manager. He was the vice president of food safety and quality for Packmore Products. and most recently at Tate & Lyle as Director of their Global Quality Systems. Evan, welcome. And with that, let's get started on our questions. I'm just going to remind our panel that try and limit your responses if you can, so we have a chance to get through them all to 2 or 3 minutes at the most, just so that we have ample time for our audience to do Q&A. All right, so let's get started. So Jill, I am going to start with you. It's been reported that millennials are now the generation in the largest numbers in the workforce, with Gen Zers coming into full force. Given the stereotypes around these new generations in the workforce, how does the generational shift impact new challenges in food safety today?
Oh, what a great question, Paul. And, you know, one of the things I hear so often right now is this people is our biggest challenge right now that we're facing as a food industry. And I think there's so many reasons, including development and engagement, meaningful work. But right now, the big thing is numbers. And with COVID, it kind of highlighted some of these challenges that we have with recruiting and engaging people, and how do we keep them here? And that's about culture. And I bring that up because culture is very much related to this new generation. And I hear people say, gosh, this new generation doesn't want to work. And I chuckle because that's the same thing that people said about us as we were coming into the food industry. And so I would really like to challenge people to kind of look at this with a different perspective, because the millennials and Gen Zers that I know, they work hard and they work smart. And they have these fresh eyes to look at what we've been doing, and they're curious why we make it so hard. And I, you know, consider that they are digital natives. So they haven't known life without apps or things on demand. And I think, how can we embrace this perspective of them being digital natives to help streamline the work we do? You know, and on top of that, what I think is really amazing is that what they bring is this focus on meaningful work and being appreciated and having ongoing conversations instead of those annual reviews that we're all used to. But they want to focus on strengths and working in those strengths versus we were always taught to like focus on weaknesses and build those. And so I think it's really cool that they look at things as how do they, you know, they don't live to work. And those are things that we all want too, just a little bit different. And what I find is that millennials and Gen Zers kind of challenge our long-held beliefs, like, why do we work 24/7, 365? Why does work come before other things in our life? And that gives us something new to consider. And so when we look at this shift that we're seeing generationally, what I think about is, how do we build a strategic plan around how we're going to provide clarity in roles? How can we expect meaningful appreciation from people in leadership, not just another pizza party, so that these generations feel appreciated? How do we build development plans that focus more on just technical skills? Because we need to be intentional with building leadership skills for everyone on teams, because regardless of the generation or role that they're currently in, everyone is a leader, either with direct reports, indirect reports, or influentially. So I know that's a long answer, but really my best advice is embrace new ideas, partner with millennials, and, you know, have a plan.
Yeah, that's amazing perspective. Actually, I really appreciate that. I've been at several conferences over the last couple of months, and you know, one was for executive food safety and quality individuals, and the other was with respect to the supply chain, but also at the executive level. And exactly that message that you just said, Jill, is the resounding message that was left with everybody who attended those conferences, that the biggest challenge right now is not only necessarily supply chain issues, which is also massive right now, but the resources and the ability to try and mitigate the attrition in a business. It's been just horrendous for everybody that I've spoken to. So I really appreciate that. Okay, great. Evan, the FDA has been stepping up the enforcement of the FSVP rule with citations and warning letters, or 483s, issued for non-compliance. In your opinion, what do you think a manufacturing site can do to ensure compliance if they purchased imported food products? Let me know what your thought is on that.
Very good. No, I appreciate you bringing this up because there's been a lot of confusion. Sometimes the topic is a bit nebulous, and I wanted to clear the air and differentiate between a manufacturing site versus a standalone agent, broker, distributor, and the potential for something like what we call a hot potato, meaning that everyone is pointing to everyone else, thinking someone else is doing something. And so the good news is for manufacturing sites, if they have a system in place, a basic food safety and quality management system, and even better, if they have certification to a GFSI-based standard, then they would have a supplier approval program, meaning that they already have a very strong foundation to have the mechanism to ensure compliance. And so what they would need to do from there, instead of having to start from scratch and say, oh, I need to start FSVP completely from the ground up, is look at those sources of supply, the ones that they might be getting products directly from overseas from that supplier, and ensure that they have the key documents in order. But it is not just black and white like that. So depending on the supply chain, if they were to get something from a broker or an agent or a distributor, perhaps that entity would be the one that would be responsible. So the key thing we want to know is, who is the FSVP importer? And that is in the eyes of the FDA, who's going to be responsible for that product when it comes to the port? And it's not something they're necessarily going to look at that moment, but later on if there's a question. So for anything that a manufacturing site's getting, they want to make sure they understand, for those that are coming from outside the US, including Canada, and Mexico, et cetera, so it doesn't matter if it's land or air or sea, are they purchasing directly from that manufacturer outside the country, or are they getting it from another entity within the U.S.? And if so, is that entity going to be taking responsibility? So the key is if they have a DUNS number registered with that, with the paperwork. And so that's a conversation to have if there's any intermediaries. So certainly if there's something they're purchasing directly from overseas, then they want to make sure they have the appropriate documentation on file. If they follow the GFSI requirements, they should be in good shape, but need to keep in mind that if there is a kill step involved, or a pesticide residue, or a mycotoxin residue or something they're concerned about that they can't control from their supplier, they need to have a full audit report showing that those specific preventive controls are being adequately controlled at that supplier before they get it. So that's a little bit in a nutshell, but in short, the good news is that if they are a manufacturer, they should already have a supplier approval program, and they would take that relevant portion and apply that to the overseas supplier, or put the burden on the agent, broker, or distributor that is importing the product.
Right. Okay. And I know Evan's coming to us live from New York City, so you know, we appreciate all the funny sounds in the background there.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. So, okay, Jen, I'm going to ask you to also feel free to add anything in addition to what Evan just said on that. But my questions specifically for you, Jen, are: how are small businesses navigating the new regulations like FSMA or FSVP? And, you know, what do you think are some of the suggestions for those groups of people?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the conversations that I had in my corporate background with Kroger, and some of the exact same things, kind of echoing what Evan said, the knowing who the importer is one of the most important piece, and not the importer of the definition from the U.S. Customs side of it, although that is important as well. It's different for the FDA and what the FDA says that FSVP importer is. So to me, a lot of the small businesses navigating those new regulations without help, they're not doing it very well. And I know Jill and Evan and I, probably all three, have some stories that we could share about how people are doing with that arena. For my business, one of the things that I notice, you know, they want to do the right thing, but a lot of them want to just have somebody do the program for them, and then they don't necessarily want to do the investment in maintaining those programs. And FSVP, probably the biggest thing that I saw with FSVP when it first started coming out, is that everybody said, okay, I've done my work. I don't have to touch it again for 3 years, because the way the law is written, you have to do a re-verification every 3 years. And that's required based on, you know, just normal cadence of it. However, you're still needing to monitor and check on what's going on with that supplier. And a GFSI certification, as Evan mentioned, is definitely one key way to do that. Small businesses don't necessarily have the clout to be able to ask their supply chain to meet those regulations or those like strict requirements for one of the certifications. They are allowed to ask for regulation requirements. I want to be clear on that. But for GFSI standards, they're not necessarily asking for that. So then how do they manage their suppliers? How do they make sure that their suppliers are meeting their regulation requirements? And those are some of the challenges that I have seen them. And I like importers, I would probably a huge percentage of importers fall under what a small business category is, which is less than 50 people in their operating. So, and a lot of them are offices and not necessarily companies that have more of a warehouse location or a distribution center. So they're operating as paper pushers, right? And not trying to say there's anything that there's any wrong or right with the way they're managing it, but they typically did not have a food scientist on staff up until this point. So that's where companies like ours, the three of ours, can come in and assist with that process. I think that's probably, to me, some of the biggest challenges that I've seen them running into the regulation. There's a lot of other things that I'm sure we could dive into. I loved how Jill mentioned digital natives in the millennials. And that's an embracing thing that we really need to push. And I can speak at length probably on data and how data needs to be digitalized instead of being on paper. And so that's another challenge, but that goes back into really investing and maintaining the programs.
Yeah, I'm finding that a lot as well, Jen. You know, companies that are looking to, you know, have a product implemented or a system implemented or a process written, they want to have somebody come in and do that. And then they're not spending enough time on the maintenance of the program, which causes a lot of, you know, real issues down the road. And certainly something that I, you know, you and I have talked about as well with supply chain issues and risks, you know, everything from regulatory requirements to business continuity issues. There's a lot going on there that we unfortunately don't have time to unpack today. But just Evan, back to you then for a minute. There's a lot of talk right now from the FDA about swabathons. So how can a site ensure that they're well prepared with a robust EMP or environmental monitoring program?
Another really good point and is something that sometimes sites misunderstand. And it's really important to be prepared rather than be reactive should the FDA show up at your doorstep. So this way, if they are, you're confident and you know what you need to do at that point. And so one of the key things, first of all, is understand your product and process and the risks. So you really need to understand. And are there any specific hazards inherent in the products and processes that you're handling? So it might be very different if you're handling salt than it would be if you are making soup and putting that in a container to consume in 3 days in the local market. So it's really important to have a baseline program. There's a lot of templates that you can start with, but every site has to have a program that's unique for their site, because every site has what we call resident organisms and transient organisms. Sometimes they'll say a resident organism is a house pet. I put it in terms that sites can understand and engage on. And it's really important to know, based on that, in your normal operating environment, where might those resident organisms be? If there's one you don't recognize, it's transient, how did it get there? And because we're dealing with a world that we don't have yet those magic glasses where we can see those microbes, hopefully in our lifetimes, we'll start to get much closer to that and have real-time information. I'm sure in the next handful of years, we're gonna have some exciting things. But for now, we still don't have those type of technologies. So we really have to be having a methodology out there with different zones. And so we have product zones where the product contacts equipment, and then there is the adjacent areas. So sometimes product zones are zone one, and then the adjacent area is zone two. Then in that room might be zone three, and a non-product area outside could be a zone four, et cetera. And what we want to know from furthest away all the way to the closest risk to the product is how is that being controlled? What is there? What are we starting with? And what I sometimes see is sites put something together, and while I won't be able to elaborate on putting together an entire program in a few moments here, what I do find though is sites go through certain motions but don't fully understand the purpose of what they're trying to achieve. And they, if I see results that always show that they never have any kind of hits on any indicator organisms or even any pathogens anywhere in the plant, doesn't necessarily have to be in a product zone, we hope not, but then I get worried that they might not be doing it correctly. And I once heard at another conference a few years back, a story with food safety culture where the sites had people trained to do swabbing, but they were told also that if they were to find a pathogen, that they'd be fired. And that was very, very concerning because that showed culture of the facility. So, of course, if you think they're going to find anything, of course not. So culture is part of it. Full understanding of what's trying to be achieved. And if you just do the swabbing after you clean, you're not going to get the real deal. You really want to be able to know what is happening in your normal operating environment and to be able to speciate and know if there's a pattern, because whole genome sequencing is growing and growing. And what could happen is several years down the road, the FDA can come knocking at your door on something, such as years ago, there was Salmonella puna in kiwis or Newport or whatever it is that, and then they could knock at your door years later to find something. And so you want to know and keep a record of what's going on, so that way it'll help keep them focused on the areas that are at risk. And that way, if they do come in, you're confident. You'll certainly want to take duplicate swabs, et cetera, but you'll know what to expect. You'll be confident in showing control of your environment. So without getting into too much nitty gritty, if you read Appendix 6 of the PCQI book, if you take the PCQI class, it's not something they necessarily cover directly in the class, but it's a great resource to take a look at.
Right. And just real quickly, Evan, what's your opinion on swabbing? I mean, obviously, I don't think it needs to be a swabathon, but how often should organizations be swabbing in general?
So they should base it on risk, but sometimes their customers might think it's never enough. But you got to start from somewhere. So it doesn't mean you're going to do 10,000. You want to divide up in periods, such as whether it's going to be weekly or monthly, and whether you're going to do pathogen or an indicator organism. You want to make sure you're not using the same swab all over the plant, because you're not going to know then where you picked it up, and you're going to spread it everywhere. And you never want to just indiscriminately swab a product contact zone directly for a pathogen, unless there's a very good reason based on an investigation you have all the product on hold. Sometimes I see sites mistakenly misunderstand that, and they do the program backwards. So they should just have a set amount of areas with a frequency, and then based on the results, they'll fine tune that and change that up to make that more or less frequent in areas based on the risks and the results that they're finding.
Okay, perfect. That's great. Okay, thanks, Evan. So, Jen, again, talking about supplier programs, and what do you think retailers can be doing today to ensure that suppliers are meeting the various appropriate requirements that are out there today?
A lot of the activities that I did at Kroger were supporting that type of, culture, I guess, going back to the food safety culture piece of it. Holding your suppliers accountable, but actually collecting data that allows you and that you're actually reading the data, let's be clear. So there's a lot of companies that I encounter where they collect data, they put it in a file, and they never look at it again. And writing it into the legal contracts, writing it into not necessarily the legal contracts, but the business terms of the contracts of like, here's what your requirements are, holding the supply chain accountable to, and the right part of the supply chain accountable to. So we used to do one step back with the traceability rule coming in. Some categories of food, we're going to have to go a lot further back into the supply chain of holding them accountable to meeting certain certain key data element recording and that sort of thing. It's going to be more transactional. But those are the ones, those are the same companies and same level at the supply chain that we need to be holding accountable to food safety standards. And how do you get a hold of that data to be able to read it and then hold them accountable to it? So for the retailers and the large wholesalers and people who have a lot more clout, they're the ones that kind of set the stage. When GFSI rolled out, if everybody remembers, I mean, I remember it very clearly because I was at Kroger at the time and that my whole job was about that. You know, Walmart and Kroger and a few other larger companies went around the same time and said, everybody has to meet GFSI standards. And there's a lot of controversy around the GFSI standards now because we also have created an audit culture. And so that kind of lends itself, and I'm sure you have a lot of insight into that, Paul, on how that's kind of evolved over the years. But it still is a good way to hold them accountable to something. And, you know, I feel like the all or nothing, I've been hearing this trend lately, and all or nothing is not always the right mentality. Something, to Evan's point just now, you know, doing something is important. And I feel like something that we can do is easily do GFSI certifications and third-party audits to be able to get kind of a snapshot. The retailers and the wholesalers are very lean operations, just like the manufacturing industry is. There's a small amount of people doing a large amount of work, and there are thousands of suppliers that they have to monitor. So how do you monitor that in a good method to be able to hold the accountability? It's still tapping into regulatory authorities, tapping into third-party audits. You can do customer audits. We were trying to move away from that in the last 20 years. We've been trying to move away from that because of audit fatigue. I don't have a lot of good answers outside of that other than just, you know, read the audit reports, don't just collect them, or make sure that they're meeting a standard that is agreed on by a global standard, which GFSI has that authority. You know, they have a large backing of the culture of, you know, we have checks and balances in place. We have standards that you have to meet. There's an auditing firm that does the work for us. You know, so there's an auditor trained in it. They have that experience in the back, you know, in the industry that they're auditing. It's not a bakery person auditing a dairy. It's a dairy person auditing a dairy. So I feel like there's a lot of good methods with utilizing that. And GFSI standards are also very in line with the regulatory authorities. So I know that FDA and USDA have a lot of overlap on their requirements of what the GFSI standards require. They don't meet all the law requirements currently. I know they're all of the scheme owners are working towards that to be able to incorporate mm-hmm. that in. But it's a really good start, and it is something in this all or nothing type culture. So, you know, something again is better than nothing.
Right. Yeah, no, that's, I mean, I could go on for hours. I've worked with, you know, thousands of companies helping build and develop supplier programs. But again, today is not the time for me to go into that. But thank you very much for that insight. That it's very relevant and important. Now, Jill, back to you. Sorry for the long delay. But as FSQ professionals are faced with these new challenges, what shifts in knowledge or expertise do you think may be required?
Oh, that's a great question. And especially as we hear, you know, what Jen and Evan have shared about, you know, foreign supplier and environmental monitoring and supplier, there's this like ever broadening scope of expertise that's needed in our food safety quality field to navigate all these details. I don't know about you, but do you remember when it just used to be like GMPs and HACCP? And now there's all these other programs on top of that. And while there are some similarities, each one has its own nuances. And as a food safety quality professional, right, it can start to feel overwhelming. And I think they start having questions, or I did, about, well, do I need to learn it all? Do I build my team to do it? Do I outsource some of it? And so I think it's really important for food safety quality leaders to know that you don't have to know it all and you don't have to do it all alone. Because sometimes we just don't have the capacity or bandwidth to take that all on. And so, you know, when you think about that, really the most powerful action a food safety quality leader can do is prepare their organization for what are some of those risks coming and how do you close it? So I know it's I kind of go back to the build a strategic plan on what your team looks like and what skills do you need to build internally or what can you outsource. And even if you outsource, maybe it's for a while and you bring them in, or maybe it's permanent. But have that actual plan versus something just written down on the whiteboard so it actually happens. And one of the tools that I think is so important is workload capacity. I can't state that enough, because the data that helps a food safety quality team see where all of their time and resources are being spent is really important. Because as we talk about these additional things that are layered on, we really need them to be able to do these things. Like Evan had said, don't just go through the motions. We need you to actually really think about what these things mean and what value they're adding. So really, it's building that plan and have some practical steps and know you're not in it alone, because we're only going to have more and more details and requirements and regulations. So make a plan.
It's amazing insight. And Jill, I go back to when I used to, you're talking about the resources. I used to do very similar time studies with my team, and Evan may recall this back at SAI Global, but we, you know, had a team of business managers and business development people who would go out and try and onboard new people to the business. And when we took a look at everything that we were having the teams do on top of that, and then we found out how much time they actually have to call clients and talk to them and try and sell, we found out that we were giving them about 8 or 9% of their day towards that. And when you take a look over the period of the year, you know, it's just not enough time to be efficient and effective with what you're trying to accomplish. So, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that is an extremely important part to be aware of. Okay, Jen, back to you. What do you think is the number one challenge that you see with supplier compliance for things like FSVP?
There's so many things. But no, number one challenge that I think, depending on the volume that you're managing. So when I think of these importers that might be working with, you know, 20 to 30 manufacturing facilities, or somebody as large as a Kroger who's working with thousands of manufacturing facilities, and a good portion of those might be imported products. It's all about the document management, because when you're doing an FSVP, and I don't want to just limit it to FSVP, because that's not what it's about. It's about collecting documents on your suppliers, understanding who they are, knowing what programs they have. And the challenge that I see, and I just had a conversation on the Food Grad podcast as well, one of the biggest challenges that I see is that we're not investing in that data collection, automating it, making it easier for the administrative part of it. Because kind of back to your point of how much, you know, like looking at the workload capacity of people, there's so much time and effort. I would say probably 8 months out of 12, I was still gathering 80% of the information when I was at Kroger. The suppliers just, it's like, people don't prioritize the needs that we have for collecting that information. And so I feel like the biggest thing, you know, like besides on-site visits, the FDA had to back off of on-site visits on foreign soil during the pandemic. And there's been the similar back off during the pandemic for domestic as well from the United States, from the FDA. So I know that that's been a challenge, but the data collection to me is the number one challenge, that digitalization of our data, moving it in. There are so many companies still on paper. There's so many regulations coming down the pipe that are really pushing for digital information. Traceability rule is a great example. We're not talking about it enough probably. And in November, a year from now, in November, that rule is going to be in effect. And so many people have to pull within a 24-hour period, a spreadsheet of all the information that's related to products, from the lot code, the batch information, the if they have a kill step or some kind of step that manipulates the food. They have certain key data elements that they have to be able to pull. You can't do that when you're going through a file cabinet looking for paperwork from a month ago. And I would say there's still 80% of companies. I mean, you kind of play that 80-20 rule, and I'm making up statistics as I go, but I mean, like, there are a ton of companies that I encounter that are still on paper. And I'm sure Evan and Jill have seen the same thing. So, like, to me, a foundation of food safety culture is invest in automation with documents.
Right. Okay. And then, Jill, back to you. Many companies have, you know, very small but certainly mighty food safety and quality teams that are there to navigate the day-to-day operations of their food safety. But as these new challenges are presented, how do you think companies approach FSQ staffing and development to stay on top of those new challenges?
Yeah, well, clearly I'm an advocate for leadership development, specifically for people in food safety and quality, because I truly believe that what we experience is different. Our roles, our roles are different, our backgrounds are different. You know, I'll be the first to say, you know, I was a science nerd who got chosen to lead a team, and being nice and organized and focused and driven didn't necessarily make me a good leader. I wasn't bad, but leadership skills are intentional. And so I think the way companies can prepare and stay ahead of these challenges is to really look at their food safety quality staffing and development intentionally. So how do they help build leadership activities into the roles of our food safety quality teams so it's not an afterthought? I like to share an example that a food safety quality manager I was working with did the workload capacity exercise, and similar to what you had shared. You know, when they tallied up, they had like 65 hours of tasks every week, and none of it was related to team interactions or development. And so when we put that on top of this day-to-day workload, it's not forward thinking on how we navigate the next 1 to 3 years with these emerging risks. So how do we really help our teams be positioned to stay on top of these? Once again, I go back to, it's a strategic plan, and it's really being intentional in developing our leaders in food safety and quality. You know, there's so many stats out there too. You know, when you hear things like 70% of people who leave a job state it was because of their manager. So if we're going to set our food safety quality leaders up for success, we need to help do that more intentionally. So whether it's someone who's new or experienced, we need to help them learn how to engage and develop their team members so that they can retain them and grow them, and hopefully create energy around our field so we can fill the pipeline, because we need more people in food safety and quality. And we'll only do that if we can show that there's meaningful work and there's development and all of these other parts that go along with it.
I mean, Jill, that leads right back directly to culture, don't you think? You know, with the team development side of your point there, I fully agree with you. There are too many companies out there that are operating this way, and they're really just going by the seat of their pants. And, you know, people are putting out fires all day long, you know, as opposed to really putting the time in to think about the best way to run the business and develop the culture in the company.
Yeah, I absolutely agree.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, Evan, let's talk a little bit about allergens. Undeclared allergens still today are the number one reason for recalls in the United States. I mean, I can't understand that. They're still today the number one reason, and they have been for probably several years now. But what unresolved challenges do you think sites are facing out there today?
It's another really good question, because this is one of the key reasons for the design of what we have under FSMA with the food safety plan, where we took traditional HACCP and then we added some additional preventive controls besides process preventive controls, or what we would know as CCPs, and added other prerequisite programs, elevated them to that level where we could try to prevent those processes from getting out of control and continue to contribute to these recalls. And so, namely, we have several different scenarios that can contribute to that. One of them is the label being printed incorrectly in the first place. Another one is the wrong label being applied to the wrong product at the line because we have an incorrect line clearance procedure, or perhaps when there's a role change, somebody grabs the wrong role, or we don't rescind the obsolete types of labels, or there's a misunderstanding on language on the labels, what it's supposed to contain. And beside the labeling, there's also sanitation as well, where if you have different types of dissimilar allergens running and the sequencing and how do you do that, how do you clean, understanding what it means to clean to a level to ensure that an allergenic protein is removed from a line so we don't have what we call cross-contact and that inadvertently then get into another line. So we have multiple programs that can then ultimately lead to what seems like one issue when it's actually multiple different types of activities behind the scenes that are going on that sometimes are taken for granted. And when we look back, they're so basic that's sometimes it's to its own detriment, that we take things for granted that, well, who's going to mistake this label or who's going to forget to clean? And when you go back to the basics again, you start to realize that there are certain things tied to the culture. Are people motivated to want to do the right thing, even when nobody's looking, even at 3 in the morning? And it's not always about the people. I've seen warning letters written and corrective actions from sites rejected because they always go back to training, and they're not going back to the full programs. And so you can do garbage in, garbage out that way. You could train on a poor program and that's not going to get you anywhere. You have to go back far enough to understand truly what's going on, and you can have more than one root cause. So when you do a root cause analysis, sometimes that singular cause is a misnomer, and you could put in parentheses that S because you can have several things going on. So it's really understanding the different programs, what those programs contribute to and what they don't contribute to, so we can make sure the right people are aware to do the right things and to also be vigilant, because we have, as we mentioned, challenges in the industry of maintaining staffing levels and new people coming in to the site, people changing over or perhaps be absent when there's a specific key change to a program. How do we get that information to them when they come back, etc.? So there's so many of those things to be aware of, but it doesn't mean a site now has to be paralyzed and say, I don't know where to begin. So you have that method to the madness, and you can go through each of those programs systematically, make sure that you don't have gaps in your food safety plan, and you correctly have the preventive controls applied, such as a allergen or labeling preventive control and a sanitation preventive control with respect to allergens. And it could also affect pathogens as well, but the allergens are definitely something that the FDA is sick and tired of, and I've been saying that since the PCQI class first came out in 2016, and yet we continue to see those recalls and going back to the most fundamental programs and having that understanding and the vigilance there with the sites to have those in place. And now we're getting to the point where we're adding a new allergen in 2023 in the U.S. We're now going to be doing what Canada already had well established, and that is having sesame now as an additional allergen. We'll have the big nine here as well to be aware of. And if you export to other countries, you have to be aware of the allergens in the countries to where that product is being exported and labeled as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not even a technical expert like you, Evan, and I'm sick and tired of hearing about allergens. And I mean, you know, we talk about the recalls, but that's potentially millions of dollars in recall and significant brand damage to these businesses. So I think it's important everybody does their part to try and get that right. Jen, did you have anything that you wanted to add in on this from your perspective?
Oh, no. I mean, Evan's 100% right. And I've really appreciate the just a good summary and overview of that, because it's so true. It can be so many different programs and reasons for allergens to be on the list. And people see that, but it's like a collective issue. It's not necessarily, one failure. It could be multiple failures. And I do agree, like the root cause analysis, you could have multiple routes to it, and going back to that SOP and going back to the procedures and policies. When I look at it from a small and medium-sized business, I think that's where a failure happens. They do not go far enough back. They don't understand that that's where the failure is happening. And so kind of going back to that food safety culture, and I kind of wrote down, when Jill was talking, Jill, and I've said this to Jill before, she and I go back a little bit too, When I was early in my career, a lot of the small and medium-sized businesses are hiring people that are 10 to 15 years in their career, maybe, but usually less than 10. And so whenever you're looking at that challenge that the person with 10 years or less experience has, they don't have the experience to draw from to know that, oh, this might be a policy problem or a procedural problem, or that, you know, they might go back to just knee-jerk reaction, go to the training. And it's not the training. And I wish I would have known people, both like Jill and Evan, when I was at that point in my career trying to help, because the corporate level programs that are at companies that are larger, that have a large amount of manufacturing facilities, you know, the grocery retailers like Kroger and Safeway and Albertsons have had their facilities. But then whenever you also look at the Tysons, the General Mills, they have that training, they have that support and that safety net, as I would call it. They might fire people over mishaps, but most of the time they're going to work on training them and developing their leaders. When you are a manufacturing company that has one facility that can barely hire somebody for 50 grand a year, then you just don't get that same kind of caliber, quality and support structure. And, you know, I always look back at my career and go, man, if I would have known who to tap into, the network that I had at that point, and I didn't really have a good network established. So it's, you know, how do you support those individuals to go to that network and to start pulling into those resources like, hey, I have an allergen issue, I got written up. Instead of trying to solve it internally, go hire a consultant to help you that has that experience. That's the part that I see missing, the unwillingness to invest into the program and invest the resources to help those people, because they may be, they may still be learning, because they're, you know, just because you have a degree in food science and studied it for, you know, 3 out of 4 years, because let's be real, you have to do gen ed classes for food science. So you're going to have like maybe 2.5 to 3 years solid if you have a bachelor's degree of some food science knowledge. That's not enough to come out into your career and be able to make these choices. So you can do the continuing ed, you get PCQI trained, you get HACCP trained, and you go through certification processes. Eventually, you'll get to a 20-year point in your career where you're confident to make these decisions. But until then, you have to rely on your network. You have to rely on the support of experts to be able to help you. And you have to convince your leaders, so kind of going back to the leadership development part, that you need help. You can't do it by yourself.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. I mean, my goodness, everything you said is just, it's really hitting me a lot too, because I mean, I look at it the exact same way. I mean, even just today alone doing the webinar, there's nothing that, you know, in my repertoire of 35 years that I would be able to sit here and technically and soundly be able to talk at the level that all of you are. So that's why I partner with the experts, and people are not spending their, money wisely. I agree. In many cases, if you need your training, get a trainer. If you need some consulting, get some consulting help. The money that you're going to spend and invest in doing that in the beginning is going to be far less than you would if you had a recall, or that you potentially are going to spend down the road. But anyway, okay, thank you all so much. At this point now, I know that we have several questions that have come in to the audience poll. So I am going to put myself on pause. I'm going to welcome Amy back into the mix here to go through the audience Q&A. And Jill, Evan, and Jen, again, a big hearty thank you from myself to you. And I look forward to the audience questions. So over to you, Amy.
Great. Thanks so much, Paul. And thank you again to all of our panelists, as Paul said. I'm going to give you guys a couple more minutes there to quickly get those questions in as you had them. Go ahead and, as I said before, type them right into the questions tab and click send. We'll answer as many as we can in the next 10 minutes or so. But just in the meantime, I wanted to invite you all to check out our other upcoming webinars. Just like this session, all of our webinars are free to register. You can just find them all at pdrfsi.com/webinars. And we hope to see you on for the next two in our series before the end of the year. All right, but I'm going to go ahead now and open up the questions tab and see what we've got here. All right, it looks like I have a question here from Amanda. And this one is not addressed to a specific speaker, so whichever one of you wants to jump in and answer this one, feel free. This one has to do with food safety culture. how do we instill food safety in employees that are at different levels of formal education and perhaps speak multiple languages, you know, coming from different cultures and backgrounds that may not be the same as where the operation is?
Well, I'd be happy to jump in on that one, because I think one of the myths that I see around culture is that it has to be this really big program. And while that can be really helpful, I often think culture is really about these little moments. It's about the human-human connection that we're having with people and sharing and showing and learning. So even when we talk about people at in different roles and different levels of an organization, it's still about taking that time and creating space to have a conversation and to see how things are going, to ask if things could be done differently or better to make the process work better or to make it easier for people. And it's really that level of engagement. And that can even cross over differences in language. So starting in those little moments is really a good place until you can build the bigger program that creates that framework for more work to be done.
And if I can chime in, building on what Jill said, very good points. Just like when a site, they have food safety and then they're like, okay, I have to also consider quality. Quality doesn't start from scratch. You have to have already existing things to have a viable product. You have a culture. Every site has a culture, but just like as individuals, are we aware as an organization of our behaviors and what motivates the choices that are being made in a facility? What drives those decisions? And as Jill said, how do we engage people? How do we then encourage the right behaviors and reinforce those and do that? And that can transcend cultures and barriers. There's a lot of those types of things that are universally understood, just like body language, you know, when you're conversing with someone and they're standing in a posture in a way that shows they're dissatisfied or you're not aware of your own showing that as well. We want to take a step back in the organization and then solicit that feedback regardless of the language. What are people seeing, feeling, and hearing, and do they feel that there's a responsiveness going on in the organization? And you can start from that. And there's many different styles and activities that you can use. So as Jill said, it doesn't have to be something insurmountable to start with and say, oh my goodness, I have to have this really fancy program. You can build that up over time, but the first thing is really self-awareness as an organization on various things and what's motivating the decisions and behaviors that are currently being made, and then what can you do about that once you learn about it.
Absolutely. Thank you both so much for that. I think that hopefully, Amanda, that addressed your curiosity there. If you had any follow-up questions or clarifications, please feel free to pop that into the questions tab as well. All right, this one is directed at Jen. Going back to those questions about, you know, developing leaders and early career development and options as far as education, this is a very long question. I'm trying to sum it down to something that's not much easier to follow. There's not enough focus in early career for companies to ensure that leaders are nurtured. What kind of options do you see in the market now, such as, you know, coaching programs like Jill's? What's out there? What would you recommend that you've seen or experienced?
Sure. Well, I think, Jill's program is great. So I'll point over to her. I'm very excited. Safe Food and Root has partnered with Jill to incorporate that into, our conversations with our clients, because that type of program of giving confidence to people, and I'll let Jill share more about the food safety coach and what those offerings are, but finding those types of development, and I'll kind of echo what Jill and Evan both just said on the previous response, the developing a framework, I kind of compare it to, we come out of college, and especially as you are getting into your own career, so maybe speaking to the college graduates that are food science bound, we've been experienced this whole time of somebody else writing what our agenda is for the next 3 months. We've not been writing it ourselves. And I think from company perspectives and from leaders and HR perspective, you have to sit down and write that path, and you need to write it with the people who you're developing. But if you are trying to develop yourself, you've also got to do it, and you have to tap into industry associations, pull resources from them, ask questions of your peers, of your, you know, people who are senior to you, of what they've done to develop their careers. Because, I mean, it doesn't happen overnight that to gain all the confidence to be able to resist maybe arguing with an upper management person that this is the right thing to do. That's not easy to have that conversation with them. Having that confidence to be able to do it isn't something you learn in technical skill training. You know, you might have the tools, you might have the data. Learning how to take that information and be able to argue the point that this is what we need to do and use that to justify a decision. Those are some really challenging things to learn over time. From coming out of corporate Kroger, I mean, the corporations, the corporate America has leadership training that they offer, but it's you get what you take out of it. So if you don't take the information and digest it and apply it to your life, then it's not going to work well for you. If you're just attending the training because it's like requirement, then that's going to happen. So recognizing cream rises to the top, kind of pulling from my dairy background. And it really does. The people who take that information and start using it to develop themselves. And again, I kind of go back, I wish I would have known people like Jill and Evan early in my career, because I would have, and I don't know, maybe I wouldn't have tapped into them the way I should have because I might have been scared. So having that come from top down to help support those leaders is really important. I'll let Jill chime in on it too, because I think she'd probably have a lot to add in that context.
Thanks, Jen. Well, and I think, Jen, you covered a lot of it. You know, part of why I do what I do is because when I look at all the people in food safety and quality, whether it's people that were on my team or clients that I help, we kind of put people in these roles and say, well, now go lead, go figure these things out. And to Jen's point, we've had a lot of technical training, but we haven't necessarily been taught how do we transition into that. And so we don't have to have other people kind of struggle through it and have some of that pain and agony that we maybe had when we first started. So having a program that really walks you through and is on this journey with you can help you ease into that and help you find your voice and create the agency that you need to really be that food safety quality leader that you can be and that you want to be. So it's really about kind of finding those resources. So whether it's a program like mine or it's an industry group or it's, you know, I wish I would have known when I had started to even have someone maybe on retainer to ask questions and to be able to reach out to who understood what I was facing and what I was going through. That was very different than some of the other consultants that I know our organizations would bring in for like business or for operations. They didn't quite have that same perspective that would help me move forward. So really work on, my advice would be to really be that advocate for your own development and what that looks like for you.
Absolutely. Thank you both so much for that. I know we're getting close to the end of the scheduled time period for this webinar, but I did get one more question just now for Evan specifically. This one's from Stephen. Stephen's wondering, Evan, if you could please elaborate on what you mentioned regarding the protocols for speciation of Listeria environmental swabs earlier in the discussion.
Sure. So for speciation, this isn't necessarily something that you're going to find in the regulation, and sometimes people find it controversial. But what I did when I was at the sites was I wanted to know. So you're going to always want to assume it's pathogenic, but I would want to know if there's a specific resident organism, and I'd want to know, is it Listeria monocytogenes or is it Listeria grayi or Listeria innocua or something else? So it can help me to know potential sources of where it could be coming from. Oh, maybe it's rainwater coming in from the overhead door by this area over here or something else. It doesn't mean that if it's non-pathogenic and it's not monocytogenes but another species, that that's okay. It's not, because it still shows you have a sanitation issue that you do want to resolve, but at least it'll help you further in your investigation to know what's going on, and better that you know rather than the FDA coming in later on after the fact or a customer complaint finding something that you first have to grapple with that. So I am of the opinion that you want to be in the know, and whether it's listeria or whether it's salmonella, et cetera, I prefer to want it to go to that level and speciate, not because I just stop there, but because it helps to understand fully what your environment is. And truly, is there something resident or transient? I've gotten to that point where I found something. You don't always right away, but I found that there was something that was transient based on speciation that really helped to get to a root cause.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Evan. And thank you for the question, Stephen. Great to get some more discussion on that aspect. All right. I think we can wrap things up. I know we have reached our scheduled ending time, but I did just want to extend another big thank you to all of our speakers as well as all of our attendees. Thank you all so much for taking the time out of your busy day to come and listen to the presentation, and on our speaker side to come and have this discussion with all of us and share some insight on what's happening now and what's coming up in the future of the industry. So just on behalf of PGFSI and Paul, thank you again for coming and facilitating all the questions. I think we're good to wrap things up, and I wish you all a great rest of your week, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.